Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I always recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And if you can't afford Spence, my second choice then would be you. That's right. You are the best guy, the best person to represent your interests in court. After all, you were there. And you either did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said. You know who said it. You know who's lying. You know who's telling the truth. In short, you know. But your lawyer doesn't know any more than you tell him. And besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. The abhorrence of the profession is documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history. You know, Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher in King Henry VI exclaimed, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Dickens wrote, "If there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers." Poor Richard, in his almanac, said, "God works wonders now and then. Behold, a lawyer, an honest man." So scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish, always slippery. Both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial assemblies. Brigham Young, the Mormon, upon establishing his Utah Utopia, characterized lawyers as a stink in the nostrils of every Latter-day Saint, and described the courtroom as a cage of unclean birds, a den, and a kitchen of the devil. And early in the 19th century, the Baptist preacher John Leyland attacked a host of lawyers who infest our land like the swarms of locusts in Egypt that eat out every green thing. You know, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and three rules. Remember, don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and remember, it's free of charge. That number to call again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about cross-examination and how to use cross-examination to elicit the truth out of your opponent. Now, there are 23 techniques that are spelled out in Wellman's book called The Art of Cross-Examination that we're reviewing this week. The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman, written in 1902, the first series of books, or the first publication, it's the standard that we use in the legal industry, the legal profession. Every lawyer in America, every judge in America is familiar with the book, The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. To level the playing field for you pro se litigants, you need to have the same training. So we took a look at how do you tell if a person's lying, and we found out that the courts rely upon the Kwok-Ting test. The Kwok-Ting test. Three elements to decide whether or not somebody's telling the truth. And that is, the testimony that you're listening to must be complete. The testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. And number three, the testimony must be supported by witnesses and or evidence. Well, it's easy to uncover a lying, fraudulent charade. But there is a form of lying that is nigh on to impossible to uncover unless you're trained. So let's take a look at that one. What do you do with somebody who's lying, but the guy actually believes his own lie? That's the one that is the most difficult, the hardest to uncover, is a falsehood that is being told in court, under oath, by somebody who actually believes that the falsehood that he is telling is in fact the truth. And it's nigh on to impossible to shake that person's credibility, to shake that person's testimony. But there is in fact a methodology by which we get to the truth. Let me give you an illustration. Professor Hugo Munsterberg, for many years a professor of psychology at Harvard University, published a few years ago his book on the subject titled On the Witness Stand. Now, I think I may fairly claim to have introduced this book to our local legal profession in a course of lectures delivered at the Columbia Law School by my partner, Herbert C. Smith, and it was the first New York lawyer to make practical use of its theories in one of his cases and thereby completely break down damaging testimony of a witness of whose honesty and purpose there could be no question. Now, it was in a case tried some years ago before Justice Erlanger of our state Supreme Court. The suit was brought by the widow to recover a large sum of money in damages from Macy & Company, owners of a well-known department store in New York City, on account of the death of Professor John T. McNulty. Now, the plaintiff's intestate, a professor of philosophy in the College of the City of New York, met his death by falling through an open passenger elevator shaft at one of the upper floors of the building. Now, the claim on behalf of the widow was that as Professor McNulty approached the elevator, walking along the corridor on the sixth floor and intending to enter it, the waiting elevator suddenly shot up before the barricading door was closed, and the professor, stepping into the unguarded shaft, was precipitated to the bottom. On the other hand, the elevator operator, Macy & Company's only witness, insisted that Professor McNulty was not entering the elevated car at all, but on the contrary had ridden in the car up to the floor in question, that it was customary to stop the car at each landing, and that just as he, the operator, was starting it again and closing the collapsible door, the professor, suddenly realizing that he wished to get off on another floor, pushed back the partly closed door, stepping out, lost his balance, and fell backward into the shaft. Now, the case, therefore, directly turned on whether Professor McNulty fell while attempting to re-enter the car or while he was leaving the car. Now, if the former, Macy & Company, were liable for their employee's negligence, if the latter, it was the deceased's own fault. The plaintiff called a Dr. Allison as her principal and only eyewitness to the accident. He testified on direct examination that Professor McNulty walked past him on the sixth floor corridor toward the elevator shaft, which was open, and he saw him disappear there and heard the fall of his body. Now, Dr. Allison had originally told his version of the occurrence 2 days after the accident at the coroner's inquest, when he was asked by the lawyer for the deceased family the following leading questions, there being no representative of Macy & Company there to represent the company. Question. As you were walking along this corridor on the sixth floor, you saw a man's form, which afterward turned out to be Professor McNulty, passing you going forward toward the elevator shaft. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you saw this man disappear after he reached the shaft. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. The entrance to the shaft was open at the time. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you then heard the sound of the body striking the bottom. Answer. Yes, sir. It was these obviously leading questions which prompted Mr. Smith to pursue the following line of cross-examination. Question. Dr. Allison, you were examined at the coroner's inquest about this accident, were you not? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. That was only 2 days after Professor McNulty was killed. Is that correct? Answer. I believe so. Question. Well, your testimony then and now are substantially the same. Is that not true? Answer. That is true, of course. Question. Was that the first time you had ever related the occurrence? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Now, you have quite a large medical practice, have you not? Answer. Fairly large, I believe. Question. Do you have any nervous and mental cases come under your notice and care? Answer. Oh, yes. Every physician does. Question. Has that led you to take any particular interest in psychology generally, doctor? Answer. Well, that's a subject which has always been of great interest to me. Question. Then you have read considerably about it, then, have you not? Answer. Yes, I've read a great deal. Question. I suppose, of course, then, you must be familiar with Professor Munsterberg's recent book on the witness stand, which has created so much comment. Answer. Yes, indeed, I have read it. Question. Do you remember the stress that he laid on the power of suggestion and the illusions of memory? That can you recall some of the curious examples that he gave of these phenomena? Answer. Yes. If you will call my attention to them, I'm sure that I can remember them. Question. For instance, while reading from the book, in the midst of a scholarly meeting, the doors open, a clown in highly colored costume rushes in mad excitement, and a Negro with a revolver in hand follows him. They both shout wild phrases, then one falls to the ground, the other jumps on him, then a shot, and suddenly both are out of the room. The whole affair, which was prearranged, took not more than 20 seconds. The scholars are asked immediately to write down a report of what they saw. Out of 40 reports, there were only 6 which did not contain positive wrong statements. Only 4 noticed that the Negro had nothing on his head. The others gave him a derby or a high hat, and so on. Different colors and styles of clothing were invented for him. Some said he had a coat on, others that he was in his shirt sleeves. And it was determined that a majority of the observers had omitted or falsified about half of the processes which occurred completely in their field of vision. Now, do you remember that example of the frailty of memory? Answer. Yes, sir. I remember it well. Question. Then do you remember this one? Still referring to the same book. A picture of a room and a farmhouse, which was shown to a class of picked students. Then each student was asked questions as to what he had seen. Did you see where the stove was located? 59 out of 100 replied and gave the stove a definite place. Did you see the farmer's wife winding the clock? 30 of the class described the clock, and so on. There was neither a stove nor was there a clock shown in the picture. To the witness, do you remember that? Do you not? answer, yes, that was one of his examples, which quite forcibly impressed me. Question. I'm going to burden you with the relation of one more incident from Munsterberg's book, and then I'm going to ask you if you can see the relation of these cases to the one at bar. Okay, do you remember this further example from On the Witness Stand, turning to another portion of the book? A Negro was being tried for murder committed on a highway at night. A disinterested witness who claimed to have seen the whole occurrence was asked these suggestive questions on cross-examination. Did you see by the moonlight the kind of trousers, the coat, the prisoner was wearing at the time? Answer, yes, I'm sure they were brown or at least dark. As a matter of fact, there was no moonlight, and all of the other witnesses who had testified earlier said that the prisoner's attire consisted of blue trousers, white shirt, and no coat to the witness. Now, do you remember this example of the remarkable power of suggestion recorded by Professor Munsterberg? Answer, yes, sir, I do. Question. Do you appreciate, Dr. Allison, that you are yourself easily subject to the power of suggestion? Answer, no, sir, I do not. Question. Well, let us see. I now call your attention to your testimony given 2 days after the tragedy at the coroner's inquest, which I will now read to you. So counsel read his testimony as quoted above. Now, you recognize, do you not, that these questions that you were asked at the coroner's inquest for the first time brought out from you that you actually saw Professor McNulty going toward the elevator and were exactly of the kind classed as suggestive and exemplified in On the Witness Stand, do you not? Answer, that may be, but what of it? Do you mean to imply that I am testifying falsely? Question. Not intentionally. But what you are, or that you are, what is known as a suggestible witness? And the witness answered, prove it. Question. Very well. Would it surprise you to know that of the three instances that I apparently read from Munsterberg's book, and all of which you said that you remembered perfectly, only the first example, the one that I read to you first, was actually in the book. The second was only half true, and the third was an entire fabrication of my own. Here, take the book, see for yourself. And he handed the volume to the witness. The witness hesitating and his color rising. Mr. Smith, I'm afraid you're making a fool of me. Question. No, not more so than any one of us are liable to be honestly mistaken. But now, let me ask you, Doctor, and I would not put this question to you if I were not convinced of your fair-mindedness and your honesty and integrity. In view of your answers, and looking back, and in the light of your scientific knowledge, can you really say you actually saw Professor McNulty approaching the elevator shaft, or that you even saw him at all before the instant of his body disappearing down the shaft? Answer. After much hesitation, I am afraid I cannot. Now the witness, with flushed countenance, then hurriedly left the stand. The main prop to the plaintiff's case was gone, resulting in the jury finding a verdict in favor of Macy and Company. And it is obviously the province of the cross-examiner to detect the nature of any foreign element which may have been imported into a witness's memory of an event or transaction to which he testifies, and if possible, to discover the source of the error, whether the memory has been warped by desire or imagination, or whether the error was one of original perception, and if so, whence it arose, whether from a lack of attention or from wrong association of previous personal experience. Now let me pause here for a moment, and let's reflect here for a moment on what we've just seen. Here's a case similar to the one that we looked at earlier, where the cross-examiner asked a Dr. Rainey for the citation out of a book that he claimed that he had read just that morning. And of course, he could not produce that citation from Dr. Erickson's book. Do you remember that story? Now, in this case here, the cross-examiner used essentially the same tactic, asking the witness if he had read a book, and the man said, "Yes, I've read the book." And then he read an exact quotation out of the book and asked the witness, "Do you remember that?" "Yes, yes, I remember that well." Then he read a second citation that came from the book, but he put some obvious errors in it. It was only half true. And he said, "Do you remember that example?" "Yes, yes, I remember that example." Then he comes to the third one, and he says, "Do you remember this example from the book?" And the witness answered, "Yes, I remember that well, but that citation wasn't even in the book," to demonstrate to the witness the fallacy of memory. Now, all of us have memory, and we believe what we remember. Whether what we remember is true or false, we remember and we believe our memory. But as we went on to show, if you show somebody a picture and then ask them questions about it, as he pointed out in Munsterberg's book, when 100 people looked at a picture and were asked the question, "Where was the stove located?" 59 out of 100 said the stove was located somewhere in the room. And when asked, "Where was the wife standing, or do you remember the wife winding the clock?" a number of students said yes, and they placed the clock and the wife winding the clock. But remember, there was no clock and there was no stove in the picture. And this is what we call in law assuming facts, not in evidence. Assuming facts, not in evidence. We assumed that there was a clock, and we assumed that there was a stove because of the power of suggestion. Because somebody said there was a stove in the picture. Somebody said there was a clock in the picture. So you assume that there's a clock and a stove. It isn't that you remember a clock or a stove. It's that you were told there was a clock and a stove there. Now let me give you a first-hand experience that I had. One time I was in the jail in Webster County, and the sheriff there was trying to get my fingerprints and mugshot, and I wasn't being very cooperative. So they use what they call in law enforcement a little persuasion. It's known as pain compliance. Now, in ordinary terms, we call it torture. What we're going to do is inflict upon you pain until the pain becomes so great that you will comply with my wishes. And it's actually a pretty good technique. If you pull somebody's fingernails out one at a time, that's very painful. Now, if you said to somebody, "I want you to confess to this crime," and you said, "No, I will not," and he pulled out your first index fingernail, you would experience a lot of pain. Then if he said a second time, "Now, will you confess?" you might say no. But as he puts the vice grips on your second fingernail, you may have a change of heart. And you may say, "Yes, yes, I will confess to that." That's what they're doing down there in Guantanamo Bay. That's what they do in Afghanistan. Now, the American troops and American interrogators are using torture. Now, they don't use the word torture. They do not see it as torture. They see it as intelligence. We are extracting intelligence. And from our perspective, from our point of view, we're doing this to save American lives. We need this information of upcoming raids and upcoming terrorist activities so that we can intercept these activities and prevent the needless deaths of our fellow Americans. Well, it depends upon whose point of view you're looking at this scenario from. So while I was in jail, the sheriff there at the time, he wasn't too big of a fellow, and people that are small of stature suffer from what we call the little man syndrome. Little man syndrome. You might tuck that away in your heart if you're a little fella. You probably are a belligerent fellow. You're an aggressive person who's trying to prove something to somebody. That's natural. That's normal. Don't get angry with me. And if you're a big guy, you know, you're 6'16" and you're just a puffball. You don't need to be tough because you're so big. Now you take that little guy who's trying to get out of the big guy some information, and he won't give it to you. He won't cooperate. The little guy needs to then apply some force to the big guy to get the big guy to cooperate. Well, I was the big guy, and the sheriff was the little guy, and after about 5 or 6 deputies had reduced me to the floor and were jumping on top of me and doing a few other things, they twisting my arm behind my back and so on, the sheriff put his boot on the top of my head. Now, my head was sideways on the floor. I had one ear to the floor and one ear up. And the sheriff applied his boot on top of the side of my head and began to apply pressure. Now, that hurt quite a bit. And as it hurt, I let out a yell, a scream, a painful stop! Stop! Ow! Oh! You know, just yelling and screaming. People do that involuntarily when there's pain being applied. Now, sheriffs and deputies and policemen know that this is against the law. They're not dummies. They know that if they beat up on a prisoner in jail and cause him damage, such as you saw in the pictures that came from the Abu Ghraib prison, that's against the law. It violates Anglo-Saxon administration. You can't blindfold people and electrocute them. You can't tie leashes around people's neck and use dogs to bite them and cause them damage and harm. It's against the law. So when you know that, you have to temper what you're doing. You want to inflict pain, but you don't want to leave any evidence of it. So if you take your fist and you hit somebody in the mouth, his teeth are going to cut through his lips, and there's going to be blood, and there's going to be scars, which later on can be used as evidence against you in a civil rights action when you sue the sheriff and the county and collect damages. So what they do is they apply pain without leaving any marks. And oftentimes you'll hear a sheriff or a deputy say, "Don't make any marks." And when you hear them say those words, "Don't make any marks," you'll know that it's going to hurt real bad, but it isn't going to leave any evidence. Now, I've been through that 3 or 4 times, so I understand how that works. All right, now, here's the point that I'm making. While this is going on, I was moving and squirming on the floor. When pain is applied, you involuntarily jerk around. Well, the sheriff evidently lost his balance. I couldn't see what had happened or what was going on because, remember, my head is on the floor. My eyes are fixed in the opposite direction from the door. But the door to the sheriff's office, to the booking room, opened out onto the hall. It was a door that was not used. It was kept locked. But it had a Venetian blind in front of the glass panel on the door. It's an old courthouse. And in the booking room, which was off of the door that led into the sheriff's office, The Venetian blind slipped, or it fell out of its holder, and it dropped down. Now, on the other side of the window were two court clerks and my wife. My wife and two court clerks. Now, they could hear the noises going on inside, which is what attracted them to come over to the door as I was screaming and yelling in pain, suffering, and agony. My wife, being very concerned about my health and well-being, summoned the two court clerks over to the door, and as they were knocking on the door, something happened. I couldn't see what happened, but something happened, and I would assume that the sheriff moved or he bumped or in some way struck the Venetian blind, which fell down, which then left in full view of my wife and these two totally disinterested court clerks from the courthouse somewhere who happened to be in the hall. They were now looking through the window in the door, and they could see me on the floor with the sheriff's boot on my head, pushing on my ear, with three or four or five deputies holding me down and one twisting my arm behind my back, whereupon my wife uttered these words. My wife said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." Now remember those words. "Oh my God, look at the blood." And we'll come back with the rest of the story right after this. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in both the United States and worldwide over the Internet. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week, and it has our radio log, schedule, and the archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, history, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book called The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. There are 23 techniques that we use to uncover false testimony, whether the testimony now is a lie by design and the witness is lying because he wants to lie, knows he's lying, and is doing the lying with intent and purpose. Or, as we're demonstrating here, what if the witness actually believes what the witness is testifying about? So we talked about Professor McNulty had fallen down the shaft of an elevator shaft at Macy's in New York. And we're discussing the power of suggestion. So I was giving you an example of the power of suggestion. The power of suggestion. As my wife, looking through the window, said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." 7 words. "Oh my God, look at the blood." Now, when this case went to trial, both of those women when they were asked this question. What did you see when you looked through the window? And they both testified that they saw the sheriff, who they both knew and recognized, with his boot on my head, with me on the floor, writhing in agony and screaming out, with several deputies, one twisting my arm behind my back. And they described, both of them, that this was the most violent, evil, wicked scene that they had ever witnessed in their lives. They had never seen anything like this. And, you know, the average Joe Sixpack, he doesn't see things like this. Normal people don't witness this kind of thing that you saw pictures of at Abu Ghraib and down at Guantanamo Bay. I want to tell you from personal experience, it goes on every day in every jail in America. We don't call that torture in this country. We call it pain compliance. No marks are left. I've been through it four times. And I remember the first time it happened to me, the sheriff's administrative assistant, his name was Larry Richards, he uttered these words. He said, "Don't make any marks on him." And when they got through with me, boys and girls, let me tell you, I hurt for 2 weeks. I could still feel pain 2 weeks after they got through with me. And there was not a bruise. There was not a mark on my body. Now, I want to tell you that that's what goes on in America's jails today. It goes on in your prisons. It goes on in your jails. Any prisoner who's been there any length of time can tell you that. You get used to it after a while. The question arises, well, how much of this pain can you take? And various people have various and sundry pain tolerance levels. Some people can take more than others. But I will assure you that at some point in the pain application, you will comply. You may tell them total lies, but you will tell your interrogator whatever in the hell he wants to hear. You will sign whatever in the hell he puts in front of you when the pain gets to that level. In some cases, they may have to stick your arm into a boiling vat of oil to get you to sign. But you'll sign when it's all said and done. Now, getting back to the witness's testimony, let me tell you, there was no blood. I was the victim. And I'm going to tell you right now, there was no blood. I wish there was. I wanted there to be blood. I wanted blood on my clothes so that I could come into court with evidence and show that the sheriff and that these deputies had beaten up on me. Both of those court clerks came in and testified as to what they saw, what they heard, and what they knew. They testified of the beating. They testified as to what they saw. It was the most awful, evil thing they said that they had ever seen. Gave them nightmares. Well, gave one of them nightmares. I'm here to tell you there was no blood. Both of those women testified that there was blood. Now, why did they testify that there was blood everywhere? They testified that there was blood because my wife said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." My wife didn't see any blood. And that's because there wasn't any blood there. Those two women did not see any blood. And that's because there wasn't any blood there. Those two women will go to their graves believing that there was blood everywhere. They, honest to God, believe it. They, honest to God, remember it. But their memory was created by those seven words that my wife uttered while they were being subjected to an extreme trauma. The trauma was they saw somebody being beaten up. They had never heard of such a thing. They could not imagine in their wildest imaginations that the sheriff of their county and that the deputies that they knew by name would beat up and torture somebody in the Webster County Jail. They just could not fathom that. Now, the average American, when I tell you that there is beatings and torture going on in every single jail in America, without exception, and you're going to sit there and say, ha, Gordon, but you haven't been in every jail in America. Now, but I've been in probably 10 of them. And there were beatings and prisoners being subjected to torture, known as pain compliant, in all 10 of them while I was there. That's 100%. And then I went to the Miranda case, and the United States Supreme Court told me that it goes on in every jail in America. And they even identified 40,000 jails in the 1960s. There's more than that today. So I'm going to tell you that that's the way it is. And I personally experienced it, and I've interviewed many, many prisoners, many, many people in jail. Now, it doesn't happen to everybody. Most people comply. Most people give confessions. Most people do what they're told. Most people give their fingerprints. And anytime you get crosswise with the jail personnel in there, they will use whatever pain compliance that they need to get you to comply. Now, that's another subject for another day. What we're discussing here is the power of suggestion. And when the power of suggestion is used on somebody, they will believe it until they die. Now, here's what happens to rape cases. A victim who has been subjected to an extreme trauma. I'm not suggesting that women are testifying against rapists, accused rapists, pointing their finger and saying, that's the man that raped me, because they haven't been raped. They have been raped. They have been subjected to an extreme trauma. But when they are brought in to identify, the police bring them in and they show them these various subjects that the police say, is this the guy that raped you? Is this the guy that raped you? Is this the guy over here? And then the police make a suggestion. And then the policeman says, we think it's the guy down on the end, and we're relying upon you, lady, and if you don't identify that guy, or one of these guys, or identify the guy that raped you, he's going to get away with that, and he's going to go out, and he's going to do this to other women just like you, and they'll go on and on and on. We're depending upon you to help us put an end to this rapist's crime binge. And like as not, the guy has been convicted for rape in the past. And maybe for that reason, when we come in and finger this guy the second, the third, and the fourth time, and we put him away for the second, third, and fourth time, maybe he's innocent. He didn't rape this woman, but last week he was raping some other woman, and so he's going to get his just desserts anyway. I don't know. I'm not here to make those kind of judgments. I'm just here to tell you that 30% of the time, when those positive identifications are made, they're false. Statistical analysis, DNA, science proves 30% of all rape cases in the United States of America are false. That ought not to be, boys and girls. It ought not to be. But it is. And those women identify those rapists because of the power of suggestion. And you need to overcome that witness's power of suggestion. The honest-to-God belief by the witness that what he's testifying to is true, as we saw here in this McNulty case. He actually believed that it was true. Those are the toughest cases, the toughest witnesses to break down. Now, it's not impossible. Not impossible at all. You deny it, number one. You take the witness stand and withstand cross-examination, number two. And then you break that witness down. What did you actually see? What was the light? Did you see it by moonlight? Did you see it by, you know, and pretty soon you'll get the truth out. Now, these two ladies, when I took the witness stand, I said there was no blood that I could see. My wife testified later that, no, there was no blood. The two ladies, two impartial witnesses, Both testified there was blood everywhere. Now, that was false testimony on their part. And it was created by the power of suggestion. And the police create that power of suggestion, just like coroners do at the coroner's inquest, by asking leading and suggestive questions. And that's why in objections, when you ask a question that is leading and suggestive, the opposing counsel will object and the judge will sustain those questions. But in a coroner's inquest, oftentimes, there's no opposing counsel. As in this case here, there was no opposing counsel to make any objections. So the examiner could ask those leading and suggestive questions. Are you still beating your wife on Wednesday? If you ask the question, do you remember where the stove was located in the picture? Objection, leading and suggestive. There's been no evidence admitted that there was a stove in the room. There's no evidence in the record that there was a wife in the room. There's no evidence in the record that there was a clock on the wall. So you have to first of all establish that there was a room. Was there anything in the room? Yes, there was furniture. What kind of furniture was in the room? Well, there was a stove and a clock on the wall, and there was a table and chairs. And now you've established from the witness's own independent recollection that there was a stove, a clock, there was table and chairs, and various items of furniture in the room. Where was the stove located? That's not leading and suggestive. After it has been established that there was a stove in the room, now we can ask the question, which side of the room was the stove on? Which wall was the clock hanging on? Who did you see winding the clock? Now let's take a look at another example of a case where you'll have somebody here testifying. And maybe it's an expert witness. Maybe it's a partisan. Let me take a look here at partisan testimony. One sees perhaps the most marked instances of partisanship in admiralty cases which arise out of a collision between two ships. Almost invariably, all of the crew on one ship will testify in unison against the opposing crew. And what is more significant, such passengers as happen to be on either ship will almost invariably be found corroborating the stories of their respective crews. When I was a young man, about 1956, I believe it was, there was a very famous shipwreck. It was the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm. And it was in fog, and the Andrea Doria, which was a luxury passenger ship, was coming from Italy to New York Harbor, and it was rammed. The bow of the Swedish ship, the Stockholm, ran into the side of the Andrea Doria. And as a result of that, the Andrea Doria sank the next day or two or three days later. And one of the passengers on the Andrea Doria was a woman by the name of Ruth Roman. She was a movie actress. And because she was a notable person, when she got off the ship, they were picked up and hauled in, you know, off of a salvage ship. I don't remember how she got to New York. But anyway, she was asked when she got to New York, what happened? What did you see? And Miss Roman said that the ship that she was riding on, the Andrea Doria, was rammed by the Stockholm in the fog, which was the truth. And she went on to say that it was the fault of the Stockholm that they rammed our ship. We didn't ram their ship. They rammed our ship. Now, as it turns out, the fault at the inquest was laid on the Andrea Doria because of their faulty navigation. They were doing something wrong. I don't know, remember what it was that they were doing. But anyway, they were doing something wrong, and the Stockholm was doing all the right things, and Stockholm ran into them. Now, ordinarily, you would think that the ship that ran into the other ship would be the guilty ship, see? Now, in this case, it wasn't the guilty ship. But Miss Roman, I remember this. I was just, you know, a teenager at the time, probably 16, 18 years old, 20. See, in 56... In 56, I guess I was about 17 years old. Anyway, it struck me at the time, I was just a kid at the time, and it struck me, how does that woman know that it's the fault of the Stockholm? All she is a crummy passenger. She wasn't up on the bridge. She wasn't navigating the ship. She doesn't know. And so the press picked up on that, and for weeks after that, they were talking about the sinking of the Andrea Doria, and then they were always blaming it on the Stockholm. I mean, in people's mind, in my mind to this day, when I think of that shipwreck, the first thought is it was the fault of the Stockholm. About a year later, when the inquest was all completed and the findings were made, they came to the conclusion that the Andrea Doria was in the wrong place, and that they were navigating faultily. They weren't steering the ship correctly, or something on that order. Anyway, it was their navigation. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they weren't doing the right things, and it was their fault. Now, of course, I'm just a layperson. I don't know much about navigation and ships and one thing and another. I have to rely upon the experts there. But the official report is that it was the fault of the Andrea Doria. That's the report I want to give to you. But in my mind to this day, because of the power of suggestion, because of the newspaper reports that I read constantly for that year, in my mind, although I know that it was the fault of the Andrea Doria, when I think of that wreck, I immediately, my mind says it was the fault of the Stockholm, because there was dozens of articles over the period of a year talking about that wreck, of which they all laid it onto the Stockholm. Everybody was convinced that it was the Stockholm until the final report came out. There's one report that says no, it wasn't, but I have seen many reports that says yes, it was the fault of the Stockholm. So I'm here to tell you that the power of suggestion works on everybody. It works on me. It works on my wife. It works on two clerks in a courthouse who will believe to their dying day that there was blood everywhere. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, Joseph H. Choate had an amusing experience in one of his admiralty cases, which illustrates the proper way to handle such a situation when you get into partisanship. The city of New York had sued the New Haven Railroad for damages growing out of a collision between boats owned by the respective parties. The city's fireboat, the New Yorker, had been run down. As it was backing out of its slip, it was run down by a car float which one of the New Haven Railroad tugs had been most improperly towing through the North River too close to the pier ends. There was no possible denial of the tugboat's fault, and the defense had no evidence of any possible fault on the part of the fireboat, though it was hard to see how the collision could have happened if the fireboat had been keeping a proper lookout. And as usual, the crew of the fireboat was called as witnesses in succession. The first testified that he had been properly posted as a lookout and had acted accordingly. This statement proved unshakable on cross-examination, and the situation looked dark indeed. With the next witness, however, the cross-examiner decided to see whether the well-known tendency of crew witnesses to become advocates for their vessel might not be used to produce some proof in support of his belief that in spite of the first witness's testimony, there had been negligence in the keeping of the required lookout. So, the cross-examiner, accordingly, asked a number of questions as to just what the witness had been doing during the seconds leading up to and preceding the impact. These questions were carefully and purposely framed so as to suggest to the witness that the cross-examiner thought that the witness had been asleep or otherwise negligent in his duties. The witnesses, obviously annoyed by the question, "Were you looking out for possible danger?" brought an emphatic and immediate, "Yes, I was." A contemptuous, "What business was that of yours? How dare you suggest that I was derelict in my duty?" And it led the witness to reply in each and every case that he had been told to keep a lookout. Then a final question as to who had given him this order established him as a second, entirely regular lookout who had been doing his duty. The same tactics produced the same result with each succeeding member of the crew of nine. Every member of the crew jumped at the chance of defending his ship and of defending his own vigilance at the same time, and placed himself as an officially posted lookout. This, of course, left the New York's fireboat in the ridiculous position of beginning its voyage with nine specially detailed lookouts, and overlooked the question, well, if everybody's a lookout, who's running the ship? Well, this was too much for the presiding judge, who either concluded that he could not believe any of the lookouts, or that this divided responsibility had ruined the efficiency of all of them, and accordingly held the New Yorker also in fault and divided the damages. It's called contributory negligence. Now, obviously, the captain had not appointed all nine members of the crew to be lookouts on the ship. Now, remember that, partisanship. It's a very important technique, a very important tactic. What you do is you allow this person to exaggerate. And when he lies and says, "I am or I was a lookout, and yes, I was doing my duty," keep after him, keep asking him questions, and who told you to do that, and where were you standing, and what did you see, and what were you doing? And the more he talks, the more facts that he assumes. Pretty soon, he will have the stove in the room. He will have a clock on the wall. And you will have destroyed his credibility, which, after all, as a cross-examiner, is your job. If he's a truthful, honest, credible witness, he'll say, I don't know if there was a stove in the room or not. I don't know. I'm the cook. I was down in the galley. I wasn't looking for anything. I was scrambling eggs. I wasn't a lookout. Why are you asking me if I was looking out? Yes, I was doing my duty, scrambling eggs for breakfast. Yes, I was doing my duty. I was casting off the bow line. No, I was not a lookout. But I was doing my duty, casting off the bow line. The power of suggestion, boys and girls. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, history, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.